Welcome to the Tinnelly Talks podcast, where we dive into the common legal issues facing today's community associations. Whether you're a manager, board member, or homeowner, you're sure to pick up on some nuggets of advice to help you build a successful community in this ever-evolving and changing world.
Good morning, and welcome to a very, very special episode of Tinnelly Talks. And today we are coming from the third annual TLG Symposium. I am your host this morning, Kang Lee. I am a partner here at the firm. For those that have only met me on Zoom or taken my Zoom classes and only saw me today, I know what you're thinking. He looks a lot taller in person, right? I know. They say the camera adds 5 pounds. It also takes away about 5 inches. So I'm glad to see everybody here in person. We have a live studio audience with us today. I want to introduce my special guest. First off, to my left is Mark Dodge. Mark, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Mark Dodge. I'm from Desert Resort Management, an associate company in the Coachella Valley. I also work in the Temecula and Murrieta areas as well with another associate branch. I've been in this business for about 15 years. I've been the CEO of that company for almost 13 years now. And Kang invited me here because he knows that I'm probably have done this almost completely wrong my entire career. So I have a lot of good examples.
Fun fact about Mark, his man cave is a closet underneath his stairs containing thousands of vinyl records. That's and yes. The only time we ever get to share a stage is when we're at a contentious board meeting. So thank you for being here. The other manager to Mark's left is Michelle Lopez.
Thank you so much for having me. Michelle Lopez, Powerstone Property Management. I'm the Director of Community Management for the Indian Wells office in the Coachella Valley. Our corporate office is in Irvine. I'm super excited to be here. Thank you so much.
Fun fact about Michelle, I think she's the only person in the industry that has more tattoos than I do. So,
Prove it.
That's a different YouTube channel. All right, to my right are two highly distinguished TLG attorneys. Carrie Hike. I know that. I've known her for 10 years and I still get her name wrong.
Hi, good morning, everyone. My name's Carrie Hike. I'm a senior attorney with Tinnelly Law and been practicing law about 18 years now, representing corporations, most of those HOAs. And I work out of the firm's Carlsbad office. And I am on the enforcement team, which handles mostly litigation and pre-litigation matters.
Fun fact about Carrie, she is the biggest animal lover I know. I am highly allergic to most animals, yet we have bridged our divide and still get along. Next to Carrie is Corey Todd.
Thank you, Kang. Thank you all for being here. Corey Todd with the Tinnelly Law Group. I've been practicing with the firm for about 5 years now, recently elevated to the senior attorney role. I work on the enforcement / litigation team, transactional team, and I also assist with supervising Altera, the assessment collection division.
So I love Corey because he is a fellow Disney dad. We are annual members of Disneyland. We take our kids there regularly. And big news for Corey is his wife is pregnant with her third kid, what I just found out yesterday. So congratulations, Corey. All right, so for those that have never listened to our podcast or never experienced a podcast, we thought better than just sitting here telling you what the law is, we would talk about it. And the topic for today, oh, I forgot to introduce my cohort, Steve Tinnelly, who will be fielding your question. Yesterday was Steve's birthday, and he decided to celebrate by joining us today in hosting this event. Thank you, Steve. So when you see Steve today, please wish him a very happy birthday. Happy birthday, Steve.
Thanks, buddy.
Okay, so today's hot topic is something that I suspect many in the audience have had to deal with, and that is the right of entry. Has anybody ever had a time where you had to enter or believe you had to enter one of the homes in your community for whatever reason? Most likely some flood, some rodent, some pest, some nuisance. Somebody smoking too much marijuana, whatever it is. And I already saw some hands raised in the audience, right? Yeah. So the topic for today is going to be right of entry, and it's going to sort of segue into sort of dealing with that when we talk about deceased owners. Right, so what you see on the screen here is a very typical provision in most CC&Rs. And it's a provision that says the HOA has a right to enter somebody's home. And I got managers up here, and I wanted to sort of just open up the floor and say, Mark, has there ever been an occasion where you've had to exercise this provision?
Yeah, I think the most common with a deceased owner or something of that nature is, you know, the outside maintenance, right? The landscape, somebody's not in the home, landscape or the exterior maintenance on the property, ceases, for lack of a better way of saying it. That's the most common one in this instance. I've seen others, for example, I can recall one that, you know, in the frame of this conversation that we did right, was we had to run utilities through a two-story condo, and we had to get up into the drop spaces above the second stories and then run cabling down through the walls, and that required forcing cooperation from some owners that didn't want to cooperate.
How cooperative do you believe, or have you experienced owners wanting to let you guys in? Michelle, have you ever had it where these owners are like, yeah, come on in?
If only it was that easy, right? No. You have to go through the process most of the time. Mark and I were talking earlier that you need to have a feel for your community, right? And I think that most of the time, owners are not willing to let you in. They feel like you're violating their privacy. So you have to follow the processes and procedures outlined in your governing documents and utilize the HOA legal team.
Oh, speaking of lawyers, I have two distinguished lawyers to my right. But first, before I jump to them, when you get the legal advice from an attorney, has any of them ever said, go ahead and go in?
Yes.
Hopefully nobody in this room. And we'll get to what legally is right. Have you ever had an attorney tell you, go ahead and pick the lock, get a locksmith?
Yes.
Yes.
Did they ever put that in writing?
No.
No.
Okay, so let me turn to the attorneys here. Carrie, what's the proper legal way to gain entry into a home? Is there a proper legal way?
Well, the best way would be to get consent first. And then if you don't get the owner's consent, then you have to get a court order to be able to enter that unit, that lot, absent any consent by the owner.
Okay. This magical court order you're talking about, you just call up the judge, say, hey, this owner's not letting me in, judge. I just need you to write something up. Right? How does it work?
Yeah, I wish it were that easy.
No. That would be great.
No, so what you're requesting is injunctive relief here. So you're requesting an injunctive order. Injunctive relief is the court is saying you have to do something or not do something. Here would be saying you have access to this unit. So to do that, you have to, assuming it's an exigent circumstances, some sort of an emergency, you would apply for a TRO. So you go in ex parte, which means usually with court, you have to give a certain amount of notice, you file paperwork, you get a hearing set. But if you've got a leak or you have some other sort of urgent matter, you maybe can't go through that process. So you would request ex parte relief on an emergency basis to go into court to get that order to gain entry.
Okay, so let's do a hypothetical, because what I see on TV is the lawyer shows up, flashes some papers, says, hey, judge, I need something, judge grants it, right? It doesn't really happen like that in reality. So if Mark or Michelle call you on a Wednesday afternoon, they say, we need to get into this unit. We got a deceased owner, we got a water leak. Carrie, we can't get a hold of anybody. It's Wednesday, 1 p.m. We need you to go do this magical legal thing you do. Tell me the process. Tell me the timeline. What do you get that call at 1 o'clock. What do you do?
Okay, so first of all, it probably is going to take at least 24 hours to prepare all of that paperwork. There's quite a bit of paperwork, because when you're filing an application for this sort of emergency relief, you are also filing a lawsuit at the same time. That's how you get assigned a judge, a courtroom. So you're filing a lawsuit, you're filing an application for TRO, and then you're filing an application for a preliminary injunction. It's a lot of paperwork. And it has to be supported by evidence. So we need manager's cooperation in providing us with declaration, photos, everything that we can provide to really tell the judge that, yes, this is an emergency, and yes, we need to get this immediate relief.
So your quickest turnaround is 24 hours.
No.
Well,
no.
You have to sleep in between that, or what else do you have to do?
So assuming in a perfect world we get all that, we're able to prepare all that paperwork, then we have to make sure that a court date can be reserved. So, and there's notice that has to be given. So not all courtrooms hear ex partes every day of the week. Sometimes they only hear them maybe Wednesdays and Fridays.
Let's take it back. You say Wednesday, 1 o'clock, you get the call. Things are flooding, things are bad. We're now Thursday, 1 p.m. Is your paperwork done?
Thursday at 1 p.m.?
Yeah, next day.
Paperwork might be done, but that doesn't mean I'm going to get in front of a judge that week.
And you say you also need management involvement, correct?
Yes, correct.
Managers, have you ever had the experience of needing to gather evidence and paperwork to give to the attorney for a TRO?
Absolutely. You brought up something very interesting, King, because in one of our associations, one of our managers, it had nothing to do with the maintenance item, but we received a call at 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning, that there may be a death possibly in one of the condo units. And the police actually were called to it as well, and they broke the door down. So I'm wondering if there's a way around where maybe emergency people can come and do something like a water damage. I don't know, attorneys, what do you think about that? Having fire come in and kick a door down to get in there.
Very good segue. Because on the screen now is a different provision of the CCNRs where it says, hey, if it's an emergency, it seems like we can just bust down this door.
Right.
Why do we have to go through this long-winded TRO process? Attorneys, what do you think when you have one of these emergency situations? Corey?
So emergency is a term that we all think that we understand what it actually means. However, it's very open to interpretation of what someone else would actually consider emergency. And from my practice, and I think a lot of attorneys in this room would also agree, any emergency that the association is having where a first responder wouldn't be the one to go in, for example, if it was a fire that's taking place, or you know, someone who has had their personal safety and police are needed, there isn't really a situation that we have seen where we would say, this meets that emergency, you can just go and kick down the door, use that locksmith. So instead, if the first responders aren't able to do it, then you have to take the process that Carrie had mentioned, get that TRO, get that preliminary injunction, follow this procedure, otherwise you may have violated their rights, and there's a lot of fallout that can come from that.
Kang, I think the question you asked before about when that question or that issue comes back to the manager, I mean, the point you were making is that that documentation process can sometimes take several days to gather as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So we're talking about the time lapse, the cumbersome nature of this, and that can sometimes take longer than filing the court paperwork.
Because
what you guys can need from documentation from us can be sometimes time-consuming to gather.
Right, so what you guys don't really realize sometimes for attorneys, it's not just you give us a call, we magically appear in court and ask the judge to grant us what we need. We work on evidence, we work on facts, we work on records, right? So when you call us and say, hey, you need something, I would put it back on the managers, and Mark would agree, make sure you have your ducks in a row as a board, as a management company, you're documenting all of this even before you call the attorney.
Paper trail.
Very
important.
Absolutely huge.
Because when we go to the judge, we can't just tell the judge, hey, this place is flooding. Hey, this person is deceased. Hey, we need entry. We have to show the judge. And showing the judge pictures, evidence, emails, all of that.
Our good faith effort, yeah.
Right, and so what Mark's saying is managers are busy. right? They got a lot going on. They don't have just one flood. They got three floods or whatever it is. They don't always keep track of the emails. They got 200 emails a day. But when you see a situation where you might need to get the attorney involved, keep that in mind. I got to get the attorney all this information. It's just not a call and, hey, Carrie, make it happen.
And something I just want to add on top of that is judges do not liberally grant these. There needs to be substantial exigent circumstances for them to want to grant the association the ability for us to enter the unit. So we want to make sure that everything that can be shown, all the evidence, is really there and available so the judge can evaluate all the evidence at that time.
Now, Mark mentioned, and Michelle, that there have been attorneys out there who say, just go in. And they also noted that nobody ever puts that in writing. Now, the reason is the law is pretty clear to us on what should or should not happen when it comes to right of entry. What does California law say when it comes to entering somebody's home?
Well, California law does not want landlords, HOAs are considered landlords for the most part under the law, to engage in self-help. So it's been made clear in case law, and I know a lot of your governing documents will say, yeah, go on in. But you know, we all know that there are many times where the law supersedes the governing documents. And here is one such case where the law favors allowing owners the peaceful enjoyment, not disrupting the peace of that domicile. And so that is what the court will look at. The court's not gonna care necessarily if there's a flood. The court would say, well, why didn't you go in and get a court order? Because you never know what can happen in that unit. If you try to go in, you're endangering whatever vendor you're saying to, break down that door. You know, what if the person in there is armed? What if later on they claim that whoever entered the unit caused damage? You have to be very careful when you're, basically breaking down a door and busting locks and going into a unit. You really want to have a court order before you do that.
Like what you hear so far? Make sure to subscribe to the Tinley Talks podcast at tinleylaw.com and never miss an episode. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Now let's get back to the show.
So the law always looks at worst case scenario. What is the worst case scenario that could happen? Even with a provision in your CC&Rs, your governing documents that allow this to happen. Without a court overseeing it or without a court seeing what evidence you have before you undertake this, what the courts look at or what the law looks at is what's the worst that could happen beyond a flood, beyond a deceased person, is that there could be a violent interaction. You are entering somebody's home, somebody's castle, unannounced, without a court order, and that person could turn violent, the situation could turn deadly. That could be a worst case scenario or worse than the remedy that you were trying to fix in this water leak, okay? So the cases that Carrie's talking about typically concern landlord-tenant. We do not know any California cases that are specific to an HOA entering a home. Mark, Michelle, have you guys ever been sued over one of these entries that you have done?
No.
One of my managers is currently going through that. There was a fire in a condo unit, cigarette fire. We found out somehow the homeowner was deceased. They tried to contact next of kin and whoever they could. We weren't ever able to get into one of that unit. All of the other units around were reconstructed. This unit was not because we couldn't get in. So we posted notice or whatever she had to do to get in to that unit. They tore the inside out, rebuilt, and now the sister of the deceased homeowner is suing the association for all of the work.
Did you get a legal opinion for that?
Yeah, she did.
And they still got sued.
Yep.
Right, so that's how a real life cautionary tale about a situation where you believed it was okay to go in, couldn't get a hold of anybody, you posted notice, they got a legal opinion,
it's all in writing. She did everything she was supposed to.
And they still got sued. And I take it the suit, emotional distress, trespass.
They're going through it now, so
yeah. All of that.
All of that.
And there's a case up here that we're showing up on the screen where a similar situation. They thought they had a right to enter, thought they did it right, and they still got sued, plaintiff suing for emotional distress, one for emotional distress and damages, trespass. So along with that, Corey, what else could go wrong if you don't do it right?
So before I address that, there's also a couple of other situations that we have seen that I think would be relevant here, that I think a lot of the managers have also experienced is, you know, what happens if, you know, the property is vacant? You know, we still have the same recommendation. You don't actually know what's going on behind the doors you can't see into, and you still need to go throughout that court process. Now, turning back to the question, you know, beyond just having the damages, the lawsuits and things of that nature, there could, like you mentioned, Carrie, there could also be the safety concerns that take place if someone is violent within the unit, and you may have to actually utilize sheriffs to come in and actually assist with those. I think, Kang, you've actually had a similar experience to that in the past.
Yeah, so the couple times we've actually gone in with these, we've got a court order to enter with armed guards because there were squatters in there that were causing a dangerous situation. It was one time that we actually gained entry. A lot of our experience when it comes to water leaks, unfortunately, judges are they have an odd position when it comes to water leaks. I had one judge ask me, is it currently leaking as I'm sitting here today? And if I didn't answer no, he says, I'm not granting you entry, right? And as Carrie noted, and even Mark noted, the time period from when one of these leak incidents or one of these incidents occurs and the time we actually go into court is an average of at least 5 days. By the time you call us and we could turn around the paperwork and go into court and actually get a hearing, the minimum is probably 5 days. The reality is probably 7 to 10 days.
Well, Kang, that's a pretty long period of time. We're getting some questions in here that are relating to the subject matter. Thank you, everyone, for submitting them. You know, on the cases of water damage, Anonymous has a great question here. Isn't the HOA required to mitigate damages? I mean, water flowing for days. What about downstairs units, adjacent units? What about their interests? Don't we have an obligation to protect them?
Mark, what do you guys do as a management company? Do you have a protocol on just, you hear a water leak, not just getting entry into the unit, but what other steps do you guys take?
It varies.
Yeah, it varies. I mean, I have an example I can think of right off the top of my head where, specific to that question, where we had a mid-rise, four-story, where we had a leak in the top section in the water, a water leak between the walls, and it was coming down, and you could not tell exactly where it was coming from. So our choices were to shut off water for like 10 homes to figure it out. But we had a pretty good idea where it was coming from, and we had to go through this process to gain entry. And in the interim, water ran for 2 days until we turned it off. Then we had 10 units that didn't have water for ensuing six or seven days.
10 angry owners.
And 10 angry owners, yeah. I mean, I didn't answer your question, but...
No, you did. There's a difference between mitigating damages under the law and entry. Right. So what we're talking about is gaining entry. Because you can gain entry, or even if there is a long time period to possibly gain entry, that does not excuse you from trying to mitigate the damages. So if there's a water leak, you have a duty as an HOA, as a management company, to Mark's point, mitigate the damages, to try to figure out where the leak is. Now, this is happening concurrently with your efforts to gain entry into the unit. They're not mutually exclusive, right? Oh, we can't gain entry, our hands are tied. At the same time you're trying to gain entry, you're calling Carrier Corey and trying to get the legal procedure. You are calling the plumber, the maintenance people, you're calling whoever you can. You're going to the unit in the bottom, you're going to the unit or the roof at the top, you're going to the side units. You are going every which way to figure out how to stop the leak and to stop the bleeding and to mitigate the damages. You have that duty as well.
Yeah, it goes back. And then out of those 10 units, the one you can't enter is the one with the issue.
That's always right? the case. Always
and
the case.
And so we're waiting for that TRO for that 5-10 days. And then you have, like I said earlier, those 10 angry owners.
Yeah. And at the same time, you're documenting, right? You're shooting off emails, phone calls, texts. You're keeping a record of all of that. You're sending it over to your attorney as you're doing the mitigation efforts and seeking entry as well. Right? So it's sort of a three-headed monster here when you get one of these situations of all these things that you have to do. Mitigate, document, work with legal. Okay. And then let's move on to... Well, let's finish the TRO prelim discussion, because if you file the lawsuit, you go into the TRO, and the judge may or may not grant it, right? So if the judge grants it, you have an immediate order, you can go in. If the judge says, I don't think there's enough evidence here that I'm going to give you entry, what's your next step?
Unfortunately, if the judge says no to the TRO, then you have to wait for the hearing on the preliminary injunction. So that can be set out 30 days if you're lucky, but more like 60 days, maybe even more, depending. Some of the courts are very, very backlogged right now. So
let's break down. So TRO stands for Temporary Restraining Order, and that's right away within the same time of filing a lawsuit, because as Carrie mentioned, you have to file a lawsuit to go with the TRO. And if this judge says, no, I'm not granting you a temporary restraining order, he will give you the opportunity to bring a preliminary injunction. And you break those two, these are all fancy legal terms. Preliminary just means before the lawsuit ends, it's preliminary. Injunction means I'm going to make them do something before the lawsuit ends. And so you try to seek this as you file the lawsuit before the end of the lawsuit to get a similar order. It's not an emergency, but the judge will say, well, there might be enough evidence here that at the end of this lawsuit, you may win. I'm going to grant you this before the lawsuit ends. So they call it preliminary injunction as opposed to a temporary injunction. Again, to Carrie's point, that process in itself takes another 60 to 90 days from the time that this leak occurred or the incident occurred.
I think the important point here is I can only think in 15 years of two instances where we had to get a TRO for access. I can only think right off the top of my head. One was that water leak I was just talking about, and another was the utility easement issue that I was talked about at the beginning. The importance of working on dual or triple track to resolve these issues while the legal process is kind of panning out is so important. I mean, a lot of these can be resolved by the appropriate first approach, meaning we need access for X, Y, and Z. If that comes in the form of a very poorly written letter, or the first approach is bad, then other options are immediately then off the table because you've got a non-cooperative person, and usually that's a non-cooperative person to begin with. So I think the majority of these are resolved by thinking out a little bit outside the box at some points, using neighbors. I can think of another one where we had a rodent issue, like an 8-unit building, and we needed to treat the whole building, and we had the one offending owner would not let us into the unit. And how I resolved that is I got the other owners around them, ganged up on them, and, you know.
Problem solving, Mark.
But that was the best way to resolve it, right? We had one owner that had some contact or some kind of relationship with that offending owner, and they were able to get in. We were able to get in and resolve it.
It's a great resolution. Blame the neighbor.
But we were working on the TRO at the same time, and we didn't have to go through with it. I think that's a big takeaway here is solving these at the least common denominator, the lesser spot, and not going immediately to this process because it usually should be the last resort. It shouldn't be the first.
Which segues into a good topic then, right? Because if the person is deceased, if the unit is empty, and the neighbors are of no help, have you ever encountered it where you can't even find the next of kin,
right? Yes.
So I want to talk about situations for homeowners associations when there is a deceased owner. And the first topic is, when somebody passes away in a unit, do we still charge them assessments? Corey?
Thanks, Kang. Yeah, absolutely. So at the time of, you know, the owner is deceased, many times the property there's not a clear way that title is going to be transitioned. So sometimes you'll see, you know, it's husband and wife on title, and at that point it's clear and you just continue down that road. Other times, maybe it's a single individual with no next of kin, or it's held in some sort of entity that you cannot identify. So the best path there that we have found success with is utilizing the probate courts to have the property dispensed with. The best case is if there is still family members or next of kin to file that probate action, and they will be the administrators. The association has a much easier path to collect. That would be through a creditor's claim.
Yeah. Mark, Michelle, have you guys ever gone through a probate in one of your associations for a deceased owner?
I have not, but we did have a deceased owner. Her son lived with her. The home ended up going into foreclosure. HOA took over ownership of that that home. Again, we were under the impression that the son was living there from the neighbors. We posted notice to gain entry. Once we did gain entry, we ended up finding out that the son actually passed away in that home as well.
Oh, goodness.
So it was really a really gnarly scene that we walked into. He had already been taken out, but there was rumor that that may have happened from the neighbors. And so we did end up finding out that he did pass in the home. So that's an experience that we've went through with the deceased owner. We didn't have to go through any more of the legal things that the foreclosure allowed us to enter into the home.
I think Corey's point is a good one, or the underlying point there is that sometimes going after this after unpaid assessments and chasing it from that side is an easier approach than trying to gain entry to address the maintenance issue that's perceivably there. I mean, I think if you want to push the property along and get a proper owner, quote unquote, proper owner in the property, back to what I said before, which is you want to follow multiple courses and you want to choose the easiest one, and you don't wait for 3 or 4 months trying to gain entry to fix the maintenance issue when chasing the collection side and going through probate and pushing that might be the easier option.
That's a great point, Mark. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, give us, for those that aren't familiar with probate, once you break it down, what's the elementary sort of way to explain what probate is?
So essentially what happens upon someone's death, if there isn't something that the property isn't held in a trust that has the actual transition of property that's going to be done throughout the case, but even if there's just a will or if there's not a will, and there's not something clear, the heirs of the estate, the next of kin, whether it be the county, would have to actually open a probate to have the assets, including the property, dispensed with. Generally speaking, in a lot of the cases that we see, the property is the main asset or the only asset that is being dispensed with. And what happens is, you know, a probate case is open, whether it is by the next of kin, whether it's by the county administrator. Generally, the association can make a request for them to open it. And if, in the event that they won't, then the association has the right to do so in a limited capacity. But the ultimate goal for dispensing with a property is to have someone take title to the property at that time, at the end of the probate. And what's great is throughout that process, the association has a right to also file a creditor's claim to have their either an assessment balance paid, if there's a judgment that they have for attorney fees or damages, that can also be paid whether through the sale of the property or if there are other assets. So it's a really great tool that I think has been underutilized in this space to collect on these amounts, to get a new owner into the property, and then have, you know, this new assessment paying owner who's also maintaining the property there.
So let's go through a hypothetical then, right? An owner passes away January 1st. Is there a deadline for the association to interject itself into a probate or bring the probate?
Yes, this is actually one of the key things I would like everyone to take from. There are very important and strict deadlines. So 1 year from the date of death, the association has to collect on that balance. There's 1 year from the date of death. That is not the time that you find out. That is the time of their death. So If there are any signs that they may be deceased, reach out to your attorney, your collection company, to maybe do that additional investigation.
Mark, Michelle, is there anything in your guys' system or your companies where you are aware or even know when there's a deceased owner?
Usually you hear from the neighbors. The first sign is usually an unpaid assessment often, right? And you see that building and then you hear from the neighbors that there's been a death. And this was far more common 10 or 12 years ago, coming out of the last recession, where we had a lot of properties that even if there was heirs, they didn't want them.
Right.
They didn't want to take possession. So, but there was so many. There was so many in that situation then. But I think that's the first thing you usually see is the unpaid assessments.
Okay. Question, real quick, guys, from the audience here. What about in a case where you're worried someone might be deceased? What about doing a health and welfare check? You know, asking the authorities to go and do that. Have you ever utilized that process with any success?
Carrie, have you ever had to call a health and wellness check or get the county or the city involved on a situation?
There's a number of scenarios when you would do that. If you thought that, we've had hoarding situations, not just when we think someone's deceased or in distress, you can call Adult Protective Services usually.
That would be on the manager level, yeah.
And it's usually not terribly effective in getting a quick response, unless there's other casework in the system already indicating there's a problem in that particular property.
That'll usually
get attention. But the police often.
But
police,
starting that paper trail is important.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
even making the call and starting that paper trail is a great way to make sure that it's being reported, right?
Often, this should be no surprise to anybody in this room. Oftentimes, those complaints that go to county services or something like that from an HOA don't get as much weight as they should, unless, again, they're stacked on top of other known issues with that particular resident or property.
We had one of our attorneys sitting right in front of me here, Amanda, who was able to work with the city attorney, I believe it was in the city of Carlsbad, and they were going to appoint a health and wellness receiver, was that the term? Mm-hmm. So sometimes if you have to go even above and beyond the county level or the city level, you could get the city attorney involved, county council involved, and working in with conjunction with your legal counsel to try to elevate those situations beyond the municipality level.
I've also had success in utilizing Adult Protective Services for those that have behavioral issues to come and step in and provide third-party intervention to assist in that regard as well. So again, to Mark's point, not always the most responsive, but there are times where it is successful.
Where it does
so
work.
It's nice to have those avenues open as well.
I mean, have you ever successfully gotten a TRO against an alleged hoarding issue?
Today's episode is brought to you by Altera Assessment Recovery. Altera provides comprehensive, attorney-supervised assessment collection services to community associations throughout California. Trust us with your collection needs. We'll get the job done, done right, and as quickly and efficiently as possible. Altera Assessment Recovery. We're the collection team you've been looking for.
I think we have.
We did, actually.
The infrequency is the answer I'm after.
Well, we had to do it with the preliminary injunction. They didn't grant it on an emergency basis, but we have, where the hoarder, there was just so much in there, it was actually compromising the structure of the building with a weight of all of the...
I mean, oftentimes when we hear that complaint, it's just a messy house or a messy unit, right? And the true hoarding situations are less frequent than what we would hear, right?
Yeah, and apparently hoarding is an actual recognized disease by which you can get a quarter for somebody who has an illness to go in and address it and becomes a health and safety issue. I think we've only had it once or twice where you actually had an order from a judge that allow us to go remove some of these items.
Yeah, and I believe the court actually appointed the tenant guardian ad litem because she wasn't competent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the order was limited to the common area where he was, or it was a him, where his stuff was just being so bad that it was outside in the common area, and the judge would only allow us to remove or move these items from the common area.
Oh, that was a different one.
But then that was even limited to then we couldn't throw away his items. We had to essentially store it for him.
Yep.
So they're very, you know, judges are very protective of personal property, but even for a situation like that, they sort of really restricted our ability. But I want to go back to the probate, because I think that's something that a lot of us aren't familiar with in this room. Now, Corey mentioned there's sort of a one-year window to bring this probate. What happens if you miss that window?
If you miss that window, then the association will lose its ability to make that claim through probate. So that will then be bad debt. So one of the key items that I personally would like to have you all leave here is, if you are aware of that, please let your attorneys know right away so they can take the appropriate action.
And when you say bad debt, right, so if you miss that year window, the person's been deceased from January 1st, and let's say the property transfers 2 years later, is all that assessment gone?
Yeah, unfortunately so. Mm. And in addition to that, there is another strict statutory deadline that needs to be made aware of that's shorter than the 1 year, and it's actually if there is a probate action, which we love to see so that the association doesn't have to open it, so it's whether it's the county or if it's the next of kin, is if they have letters of administration that are filed, which basically has them appointed to manage the estate and administer it, then you only have 4 months from there to file your creditor's claim. So it's even shorter in that case. So again, if you're aware of probate, please let us know.
Yeah, so big deadlines, right? 1 year from the date of death, and we never really know when the actual date of death until we get a death certificate, if you ever get one. And then from the time somebody opens probate, if it's not the association, you have 40 days to make a claim.
4 months.
4 months?
4 months, sorry. 4 months to make that claim. We all in this room know about liens and the importance of filing liens. I think what is not talked about enough is the importance of probate, making a claim on probate, because if you don't do that, all that assessment that accumulates after that person is deceased, it's gone, right? You don't get it.
Yeah, and what I think is really important to know is a lot of the times when probate is opened, there is a very high success of collecting at least a portion of it, whether it's 100% or if it's you're getting 80% of it through the administration. But it is a much quicker success because the people that are handling it on the other side, whether it's the county, whether it's the family, if it's an attorney, their goal is to have the debts resolved and administer the assets. So it's not like you're fighting with a frustrated homeowner who doesn't want to pay because they have other grievances. They want to resolve it and they work with you.
Corey, we've got a great question here. So what if we have a decedent, but the association acted promptly and at least had secured its debt through recording a notice of delinquent assessment, an assessment lien on the property? Does that change things if we miss the 1 year statute?
Yeah, so that's a great thing, and we always recommend making sure that your debt is secure. There are avenues that is, if there is a this secured instrument, whether it's a lien, a judgment lien, there is additional avenues that we can pursue, whether it's still through foreclosure, that is still potentially an option given the circumstances. So always happy to review those. Those are sometimes are case specific of the way. We also have to make sure that everything is properly recorded, but it's always very important to do so. So thank you for bringing that up.
Well, let's backtrack to that. The person is deceased. You know they're deceased. Do you still go through the process of recording a lien?
Record the lien.
Yes.
Record.
Secure the debt.
And same process, they're deceased. Do you still call them to a meeting, notice and hearings and all that jazz?
So when it comes to delinquent assessments, yes, we still want you to record the lien. You secure that debt. When it comes to things like calling to a hearing for a fine, say they're not maintaining their property, I don't generally recommend that associations continue to fine when they're aware that these people are deceased. What is the goal of fines? The goal of fines is for deterrence and to bring the person into conformance with the governing documents. If they're known to be deceased and you are fining them, no court would then look at that and say, oh, that's reasonable, you're fining a deceased individual.
Right.
Yeah. What if you know that they have a relative? Mark, if you know somebody's deceased and you're in touch with a relative, would you go proceeding with fines and they're not maintaining the property? You're talking to the brother, he's like,
you're still trying to get some compliance. I mean, in that instance, especially if there's a trail to that person as a potential heir, right? I think you have a duty from my desk at that point to really, if you've got somebody in the home that's a potential heir, that, you know, should be maintaining the property and is choosing not to, to go through the motions, at least with that. If the property is truly empty,
yes,
that's a waste of time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's more what I was referring to. Thank you for that distinction.
See, going back to putting on the lien when it comes to a deceased person, it, same process, nothing changes, right? All the same procedures that are involved with imposing a lien?
That's correct, yes. There are some additional changes when it comes to service if you were to pursue further down the nonjudicial foreclosure process, but when it comes to recording a lien, it's the same process that you've gone through.
Okay, and who do you notify? Who do you send, you know, these notifications to, these?
So it's the address on record for the property. Generally, it's sent just to the property. If there are alternate mailing address, it's also sent there, but it is sent to the property. That way, if there is someone, like Mark mentioned, someone's living there, maybe it's a potential heir, hopefully they're gonna identify this, and then they'll reach out, oh, you know, we're going through probate. You then identify that you can go through that process, and that actually serves as a mechanism that we've used in the past to collect, actually.
Okay. Any final thoughts from here on the management side on some of your protocols and standards when it comes to dealing with deceased owners?
Not with deceased owners. I mean, like I said, the far more common issues that we deal with in this space are just access for maintenance, which the deceased owner is one extreme version of that. But there's a full spectrum. I mentioned before, you know, the lawyer's advice, and you know, where we told yes to proceed in this manner, and I think there's spaces there. Going on to clean up foot tall weeds in a front lawn is a significantly different set of circumstances than some of the things we're talking about here now. And I think that I mentioned we've never gotten sued for doing that, and we haven't, because we've carefully analyzed that risk and escalated the right ones at the right times and used the right alternatives. And I think that's it takes a little bit of good sense, you know, as everything we do in the HOA business takes a good dose of good sense to get through a lot of this and to decide which ones to escalate and which ones to.
Well, that brings up a good point. There's a distinction sometimes between, let's say, exclusive use common area, a front yard, versus breaking into somebody's door. And what you're suggesting is you believe on the management side, or you evaluated a little bit lower risk on some of these other property distinctions as actually going into the
correct
home?
Yeah, correct. I mean, the in my view, I mean, the ones we're talking about are the extreme ones, which is we got to get access for a rodent issue, for a water intrusion issue, for an abandoned property issue, for a hoarding issue. Those are extreme circumstances and far, far less frequent than a whole litany of other things that we deal with.
Okay, last thought. Attorneys, does the law draw a distinction between exclusive use common area and the home when it comes to right of entry? Mm-hmm. Pop quiz.
I don't think so.
No, it does not. So that, I'm gonna leave it there. You guys have been a great audience. Thank you, guests, for the thoughtful and fruitful conversation, and attorneys. And without any further ado, see if we have any of the last questions from the audience.
What about if someone's dead and there's an extreme noxious odor that's entering the unit? What about the noxious odors affecting other people? Is that a
Febreze? I don't know. That's
call
law enforcement. Okay.
Those are the ones the police will usually deal with.
Those are the ones police. Well, there you go. So thank you for the question. Who submitted that one? Anonymous. Anonymous is submitting a lot of questions today. Don't be afraid, guys. You can put your name in, but we'll still rock Anonymous. All right. Is that it? So we're done with the podcast. We'll
that's
end it.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Perfect.
To share or subscribe to the Tinnelly Talks podcast, visit us at tinnellylaw.com. There you can find links to everything discussed in this episode, locate helpful resources, check out other episodes, and submit questions for future topics. And be sure to tune in next month for our next episode. As always, the views and opinions expressed by the podcast, its presenters and guests do not constitute legal advice. For more information on the topics discussed in today's podcast, please consult with your association's legal counsel. This is Tinnelly Talks, presented by Tinnelly Law Group, your community, your counsel.